They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, Ryan McDonough is here, former general manager of the Phoenix Suns, the co-host of Scalin Pals, which you can hear Monday through Friday at noon Eastern on radio.com and the radio.com app. He is back again for another appearance on the show. Ryan, what's up, man?
Hey, Chris, always great to be back with you. I take it as a good sign that you invited me back. I imagine the ratings for my first appearance were off the charts. And so due to overwhelming demand on your pod, the Crossover Pod, Chris, I'm always great to be on with you, especially in the midst of the NBA Finals as we get ready for the draft, free agency, and what is an unprecedented offseason in the NBA.
That should be a wild one. Before we get to the offseason, as we record this, the Lakers are up 3-1 on the Heat. And I don't want to, look, anything can happen, especially in a final series. We've seen as recently as, 5 years ago, 4 years ago, a team lose after a 3-1, falling into a 3-1 hole. But, you know, the Lakers are in a strong position here. And if they're able to close Miami out, I look at this as being a pretty significant accomplishment in LeBron James's career. I don't think anything will top the championship that he won in Cleveland. I mean, that was such a significant moment to win one for the city, to come back, like I said, from 3-1 down to beat the Golden State Warriors, you know, the best regular season team in NBA history. I mean, that probably will always stand alone as LeBron's most significant accomplishment. But if the Lakers can close this series out, Ryan, I think this is number two. To do this at 35 years old, to have a new supporting cast around him, and to do it in year one, I mean, there are arguments that, you know, against that, but I look at this as being his would be his second most significant accomplishment. How do you see it?
Well, it's certainly up there, Chris, and he's had such a tremendous career that we have a lot of moments to choose from now in his 10th NBA Finals, trying to lead his third different team to a championship, to be the best player on three different championship-winning teams, what I think be unprecedented, at least in recent NBA history. So in my mind, Chris, I go all the way back as far as significant moments in LeBron James' career. I go back to 2012 when I was in the Celtics front office, Game 6 in the Garden in the Eastern Conference semifinals. The Celtics had a 3-2 lead. Miami was on the road. The super team had lost the year before to Dirk Nowitzki and the Dallas Mavericks. They were upset in the finals, and now LeBron was on the ropes. And I bring that up, Chris, because that is one of the greatest individual performances I've ever seen, what LeBron did in Game 6. I think he had 45 points that night. He was completely dominant. And for me, that started completely changing the trajectory of his career. And from there, it snowballed the two championships in Miami, starting with that year, and then the next year, and then Cleveland, as you mentioned. That's the ultimate. Not only the championship they won in Cleveland, Chris, I mean, that'll be remembered in Ohio forever. But also the year before, keep in mind that he had his team leading the NBA Finals with like Matthew Dellavedova as the second best player, you know, without the injuries to Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love. So certainly has a ton of accomplishments at a high level. But what he's been able to do in a unique season with a four-month layoff, with a pandemic, playing without home court advantage, which they worked hard for all year. And then especially, Chris, in year 17 at 35 years old, he'll be 36 here in a couple months. What he's been able to do with an extended layoff, getting his body, getting his mind, and getting his team ready to play in Orlando, where clearly they've been the best team and are now one game away from winning a championship. Yeah, I think that's right up there. And I agree with your assessment, probably right behind the 2016 title he won with the Cleveland Cavaliers.
Yeah, 2012 was when LeBron proved that he was a winner. You know, before then, he had been a guy that was enormously talented but hadn't won anything. To beat the Celtics in the Garden the way that he did, you know, was a statement. I remember that one pretty vividly as well. Then they went on, and I believe they beat the Thunder in four games. I mean, that was a beating they put on Oklahoma City in the finals that year. But beating the Celtics and, you know, kind of getting that proverbial, you know, monkey off his back, I think that was a significant accomplishment in LeBron's career. This, to me, though, would be the second most significant. And I say that because, you know, I wrote a column on Wednesday that Lakers fans have gleefully chimed in on, because I don't want to hear from Lakers fans that said, or at least saying, like, you never believed in us. This was, we should have been the favorites all along. We all saw this coming. There is no freaking way that back in September, when you had like Dwight Howard before all this happened, when you had Rajon Rondo coming off not a great year with the Lakers the year before, a new supporting cast, Avery Bradley, who nobody in LA wanted. Everybody in LA remembered Avery Bradley, the Clipper, not Avery Bradley, the player he obviously still is. I didn't see this Lakers run coming. I believe they were, you know, after they got going, you know, clearly they were a playoff team, but even as going into the pandemic, I don't think I ranked the Lakers as the number one team in all this. Like, take me back to what you thought, Ryan, about what this team was when it was kind of formally assembled in the offseason. Did you look at this group as being, you know, with LeBron and AD, they should be the front runner, or did you think something different?
No, I did not think they were the front runner. I thought the other team in LA, the Clippers, were the front runner with their talent and depth, especially coming off the bench with Lou Williams and Montrezl Harrell. So I picked the Clippers to win the championship before the season started. I also picked the Clippers to win the championship before the Orlando bubble started. And, you know, they now famously, infamously flamed out in the conference semifinals after blowing the 3-1 lead against the Denver Nuggets. And Doc Rivers is out, and be a very interesting offseason for the LA Clippers. But for the Lakers, Chris, what I really underestimated, to be honest with you, is their bench. I thought LeBron and AD are great. We all know what they're capable of, and they've done together what I thought they would do, but what helped them in the regular season as far as being the best team in the Western Conference, having the number one seed in the West and having the second best record in the league, trailing only the Milwaukee Bucks before the pandemic shut the league down on March 11th. What I really underestimated, Chris, was one, in the regular season playing 60 plus games, that LeBron and AD would be as healthy as they were, be able to play as consistently as they did. That I think helped the team get off to a great start before the shutdown in March. But what I really underestimated, what is now showing true in the Orlando bubble, is the talent coming off their bench. And, you know, guys like Rajon Rondo and Dwight Howard, those two in particular, Chris, you know those guys as well as anybody. We had Rondo for 9 years when I was in the Celtics front office. You know, his career arc, as is Dwight Howard's, is convoluted and complicated. Both of those guys were very talented young players whose teams wanted a high level. They had a mid-career dip, and now on the biggest stage, Dwight Howard, especially in the conference final against Nikola Jokic and the Denver Nuggets, shined, and Rajon Rondo, now for the third series in a row since returning from injury in the second round against the Houston Rockets, he's playing great. So that's what I underestimated, especially when Avery Bradley opted out of the restart. Chris, I looked at the Lakers roster, the backcourt in particular, and said, boy, I don't know if they have enough talent and depth to win at the highest levels. But with the play of Rondo, with Alex Caruso really stepping up, especially defensively, and then contributions from role players like Dwight Howard, who they got on a minimum, like Markieff Morris, who they got in a buyout from the Detroit Pistons, they've really solidified themselves as clearly the best team in the bubble. And that's a huge reason they're now only one game away from winning the 17th championship in the history of the Lakers franchise.
You know, you bring up something interesting with Rondo. When he was in Boston, I mean, he was great. He was the floor general for those Celtics teams, a huge asset to Doc Rivers when he was there. And really, since the trade that sent him to Dallas and the conflict he had with Rick Carlisle, the market for Rajon Rondo has been minimal. I mean, really, if it weren't for the Lakers this past offseason, I'm not exactly sure where Rajon Rondo would have landed. Give me your perspective as a guy that was, you know, you were running a team for a number of years. You, at times, had holes at the point guard position. You were not someone that, at least to my knowledge, actively pursued a Rajon Rondo. Did the mindset around the league about Rondo change after his time in Boston? Give me a little insight into what people have thought of Rondo in recent years.
Yeah, I know Rondo as well as just about anybody in the league. Chris, you know, I scouted him in 2005, 2006 with the Boston Celtics in the front office working for Danny Ainge. And then we drafted him in the 06 draft and had him, I think I said earlier it was 9 years, it was seven. I was there from 06 to 2013. before I got hired by the Phoenix Suns as the GM. So I know Rajon very well. What happened, Chris, is the perception around the league, as you know, sometimes spreads, and it has spread with those two guys in particular, Dwight Howard and Rajon Rondo. And the perception of Rajon that was almost unanimous league-wide was that, well, he's talented, but he's moody. He picks and chooses when he wants to play. Yes, on a good team, can he contribute? Can he play at a high level in the playoffs? But who has that team? And obviously, which team? There aren't very many, Chris, as you know, that can guarantee that they will be in the playoffs playing at a high level and are willing to deal with some of the ups and downs, especially of a younger, less mature Rondo through the regular season. So I think that's what's happened, is that he has grown up, he has matured, and also he's found the perfect role and the perfect spot playing alongside two superstars in LeBron James and Anthony Davis. And I think it's hard sometimes, Chris, especially for young players who experience a lot of success and make a lot of money, like Rajon Rondo did early in his career. I think a lot of times guys feel like that'll last forever and they'll continue to be in the conference finals or NBA finals just about every year. And I think in the case of Rajon or even the case of Dwight Howard, they realize, you know, sometimes they have to hit rock bottom for the light to come on and say, wait a minute, this isn't as easy as it seemed. I've been humbled. Now I want to sacrifice. Now I want to play a role on a team and do whatever it takes to win. And clearly that is what Rajon Rondo has done, where, in my opinion, throughout this Lakers playoff run, he's been their third best player behind only LeBron James and Anthony Davis.
Yeah, one of the smartest players of this generation, too. I mean, just a really intelligent basketball mind out there. If you're the Lakers, and we'll get into some other offseason stuff, but if you're the Lakers, do you just run this thing back next year? I mean, do you bring everybody back that you possibly can bring back and do it all over again? I mean, is there any need, given the result of this year, for a substantial change? Or do you have to start looking at, you know, potential opponents, whether it's Golden State with some of the firepower they have coming back next year, or even Brooklyn with what they have going on? I mean, how do you, if you're Rob Pelinka, how do you approach this offseason?
Yeah, I'd largely bring the same group back. I mean, they've proven that clearly they're the best team in the league right now. They've been the best team in the Orlando bubble. They have a chance to win their fourth series in a row in five games, which would be a tremendous run, you know, through a loaded Western Conference and then against a very good Miami Heat team. If they can win all those series in five games, then they really, you know, weren't it'd be hard to say they were pressed too much. And keep in mind, again, as I mentioned, Avery Bradley opted out. He'll come back next year. But they do have a lot of, you know, financial questions. It'd be interesting to see how the Buss family spends, Chris. As you know, with the pandemic, revenues are down league-wide. The Lakers are one of the highest grossing teams. Their TV deal is huge. When they can sell tickets and actually have fans in the arena, they make a ton of money off of that, as much as any team in the league, maybe other than the New York Knicks. But they have a lot of questions. Next year, Anthony Davis has a player option. He can opt out and become an unrestricted free agent. They also have player options for Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, Avery Bradley, JaVale McGee, Rajon Rondo. So they don't have a lot of cost control. So it'd be interesting to see if they're spending. And then the other challenge, Chris, you know, when you win at a high level and guys take less to win, I'm focused on Rondo and Dwight Howard in particular, is their market appreciates. Now they're not minimum players anymore. Even if a year ago they had to take a minimum deal from the Lakers because, you know, basically that's all they could get, or they wanted to play for a championship. Now they'll have a market, I would imagine, beyond the minimum. So, you know, are you able to retain those with limited financial flexibility? But to answer your question, yes, if I'm Rob Pelinka or working with Rob in the Lakers front office, I'm doing everything I can to bring this group back because the team has proven it can win at a high level. And with LeBron James prime, you know, seemingly going on forever, at some point, as you know, Chris, it'll end. But with him and the team gelling so well, I try to keep the group together, run it back, and try to compete for another championship next season.
So you mentioned Dwight Howard and market appreciation. I mean, has there been a market appreciation for Dwight Howard? I mean, he seems to have slipped into this role pretty effortlessly at this point. But it's kind of the perfect situation for him, right? I mean, he's on a team with veterans, a team that's not going to stand for any kind of, you know, distractions in that locker room. You know, is there a market beyond the Lakers, do you think, for Dwight Howard?
I think there'd be a very limited market of teams that are contenders or think they are contenders, Chris. And what I mean by that is this isn't the right team because it didn't work out there before. But a team like the Houston Rockets, who, you know, they're obviously smaller. I think their lack of size, their lack of rebounding and rim protection at times in particular was exposed. But that kind of team, Chris, the second-tier contender who may need a big, you know, would he be a good lob threat for Luka Doncic in Dallas, you know, play alongside or with Porzingis or backup Porzingis? I think he could be effective on a team like that. But those are the teams that are solid playoff teams next year and have aspirations of, you know, getting to the conference finals or NBA finals or trying to win a championship. I think that there and only there is where Dwight makes sense. If I were a middling team, or especially if I were a building team, I would not want, you know, him necessarily around the group. And I don't think that would be a good fit either way for the team, for the young players, or for Dwight Howard individually. So I think there'll be a somewhat limited market, but he certainly played a big role for the Lakers. And what has really impressed me, Chris, and this is only applicable to Dwight Howard, but the entire Lakers team, is that how those guys have acted when they're not playing. You know, it's easy to be a rah-rah when you're playing well and the team is playing well, to be supportive and engaged. It seems to me like Dwight and McGee and a lot of the role players for the Lakers have been that way when they are playing and playing well, but also when they're not playing. And that's why, in addition to the high-end talent led by LeBron James and Anthony Davis, I feel like that's a big reason the Lakers are having so much success in the Orlando bubble.
I mean, if you're Dwight Howard, you're crazy if you're looking elsewhere. I mean, you're bonkers. You're a guy that's made, you know, close to $250 million in career earnings on the court. God knows how much more you made early in your career in sneaker deals and whatever. Like, you want to spend the twilight of your career in a role for a winner. I mean, you're probably going to make the Hall of Fame anyway, but you have a chance, if you're Dwight Howard, in my mind, to, you know, kind of erase some of the stink that's on you from that middle part in your career when you were engineering the Dwightmare in Orlando and you were, you know, just this, there's so many bad stories about you, whether it's your first go around in LA or Houston or Charlotte or anywhere. I mean, if you're Dwight Howard, and I hope he's getting this advice, like, if the Lakers want you back, even if it's on, you know, kind of that veteran's minimum or some kind of lower exception salary, you got to jump at that. Like, just finish your career in Los Angeles. You get to live in LA. You get to play with LeBron James. You maybe get to win multiple championships. I mean, you would get to not rewrite the narrative of your career, but change it significantly if you're stepping into that role. Am I wrong with that? Like, if you're Dwight, like, if somebody offers you like $5 million, don't do it. Don't be stupid. Like, take the little bit less money to play in a winning situation, in a situation that makes sense for you. I mean, look, I think at this point, Dwight's pretty well established as a starting center with the Lakers. I mean, I think going in next year, if he's still there, he would be the guy ahead of JaVale McGee. Like, you get a good role on a great team. I mean, maybe it's easy for me to say turn down a couple million bucks, but when you've made as much as Dwight has made, leave it on the table, man. Go out there and get the best possible role.
Yeah, I agree with you, Chris. The million-dollar question, literally in this case, the one we don't know is, you know, with all the money Dwight has made, how much has he saved? How's he invested it? But at the end of the day, if money is not a concern for Dwight, which I think and hope it's not, given how much he's made over the course of his career, then he should absolutely stay with the Lakers. It is the best situation. And I think the respect that he has for LeBron James in particular, falling in line, playing off LeBron in terms of on the court for, you know, lobs and dunks and things like that around the basket, but also, you know, from the leadership aspect, I think that's what Dwight needs, Chris. He needs a leader. He needs a firm hand, a veteran presence who, you know, Dwight says, all right, as you know, he has, you know, the ability at times to act out and do things that I think most people would consider immature. But if LeBron James is on the team and if that team is a championship contender, which clearly the Lakers are this year, one win away from another title, and they should very, very much so be again next year if they run it back, then I think that's the perfect role for Dwight Howard. So, yeah, if it's not about the money, he should stay with the Lakers. If he does need more money, then, you know, like most people, most players, coaches, executives, whatever, in that case, he'll probably go to the highest bidder.
So the ratings for these NBA finals have been pretty far down. They have been a large percentage off, depending on which game we're talking about, 20%, 30%, 40%, and big numbers that they're down from previous NBA finals. And we know they're taking place at a different time, in a different television landscape. In June, you're not competing with anything but regular season baseball. In September and October, you're competing with the NFL, with college football, with the saturation of sports that has taken place because of this pandemic. You've worked, though, for owners, Boston and Arizona. How concerning do you think this is to NBA owners when they see numbers like this being as down as they are? How troublesome do you think it is?
Well, it's concerning. It should be concerning for the players as well, because as you know, Chris, the revenue split with the BRI is essentially 50-50. The owners get half and the players get half. So if the TV revenues and ratings are way down, the pie is smaller. It's a smaller pie to split up between the players and the owners. One of the things I've heard that's been discussed at the league level with the teams is trying to extend the national TV contracts, either with ESPN and Turner, do early extensions and front load some of the money. So you basically, you take maybe more up front or give the teams more now to help their balance sheets until we're able to return to normal life with a vaccine and fans in the stands. And, you and I have heard Adam Silver say that's about 40% of the revenue for the league is ticket sales and things related to going to games with fans. So I think that's all very important, Chris, but I wouldn't overreact to it in the sense that it's an unusual time. And if you look at other ratings as well, if you look at golf, golf is down. If you look at baseball, that's down. I think, Chris, that's because, as you mentioned, the NFL from a TV ratings perspective clearly is king. But what you have now is, since there was a delay in the spring and early summer when there were no sports, with all these sports going on at the same time, there's just, even if you're a diehard sports fan, you can't watch them all at the same time. And there are Triple Crown horse races going on and things in the fall that never happen this time of year. So I think it's, somewhat concerning for the league. I think it's more informative as far as those who have said, well, the NBA should flip their calendar. The NBA shouldn't start in October. Nobody pays attention in October. They should start on Christmas or after the new year. Well, I think that what they found, Chris, the people who said that, is you really don't want to go up against football. So whatever the NBA does, whether it's having the normal October to June calendar, even I think you could get away with playing into July or August, although the TV metrics will tell you that ratings go down once you get into July and after the 4th of July. That's something I've heard Adam Silver say personally in GM meetings and whatnot. So my guess is the league, as quickly as they can, they will try to gradually shift back to the normal schedule from October to June, because in my opinion, Chris, if you have a time when ratings are down, personally, I'd rather have that be, and I think from a business perspective, it makes more sense to have that be at the beginning of the season, October, November, December. If people don't watch the first two or three months at a high level and they really tune in around Christmas or when football dwindles down, that's fine with me personally. As a 15-plus year executive and now as a broadcaster, I'd rather have more people watching when the games are more valuable in the playoffs in April, May, and into June, especially during the NBA Finals. I'd rather have that not competing against football and have, I don't say a monopoly, but the lion's share of TV watchers and viewers focused on your sport and your finals, because as you know, that's when you get the biggest ratings.
I mean, look, it's genuinely concerning when the numbers are what they are. I would say I don't think it's going to stop, whether it's ESPN, Turner, whoever makes a bid for NBA rights, it's not going to stop them from opening up their wallets and, putting forth a big contract. Live TV or live events is the most valuable property in television right now, and there'll be a street fight for those NBA rights if they do ultimately become available. So it's not good. I don't know what I attribute it to. Is it most likely it's the saturation of sports at this time? And I think, some people would argue it's, the NBA's embracing of, a liberal agenda, so to speak. I don't know if I buy that entirely either. But either way, I don't think it affects their bottom line long term. I think that TV deal is going to be incredibly big whenever they wind up doing a new one. And this will be a little more than a blip on the proverbial radar. All right, let's talk about the Philadelphia 76ers, another coach that you're very familiar with, Doc Rivers. It seemed like, overnight, Doc Rivers was the coach of the Clippers, and now he's the coach of the Philadelphia 76ers. Give me your thoughts on, the Sixers moving quickly and hiring Doc Rivers.
Yeah, I love the hire for the Philadelphia 76ers, Chris. I worked with Doc Rivers for 9 years in the Celtics front office. We had a good run there. I think the last 6 years we're in the playoffs every year and three conference finals, two NBA finals, and the championship in 2008. And I bring that only because, yes, I am biased. Doc is a friend, and I have a lot of respect for him both personally and professionally. And frankly, I was surprised that he did it so quickly. As you mentioned, he was fired by the Philadelphia 76ers, by the LA Clippers, somewhat surprisingly, and within 24 hours of that announcement, he was on a cross-country flight going to Philadelphia to meet with Elton Brand and the ownership group of the 76ers. I didn't know if, Doc would kind of go through the process and decide, hey, look, I've been coaching at a high level for a long time. a decade or so with the Boston Celtics, Chris, and then 7 years in a row with the Clippers, six playoff appearances in LA. He's the winningest coach in the history of that franchise. You know, I obviously never got him over the hump to the conference finals or into the NBA finals, but, you know, they were as good as just about any team in the league in the regular season. And as you look at overall win percentage in that 7 year stretch. So, you know, I think for Doc Rivers, it would have been, you know, at least crossed his mind to take some time off. As you know, he's a very marketable guy, even from a non-coaching perspective. If he wants to go into broadcasting or go back to broadcasting, I should say, those opportunities are clearly available for him at a high level. So I understand why the Philadelphia 76ers went after him aggressively. I give a lot of credit to Elton Brand and their owners. I think he's the perfect fit there because I think he will hold Joel Embiid accountable and get him in shape. That is what Embiid needs, in my opinion. And then also be firm with Ben Simmons. You know, Simmons is a very talented player, as you know, Chris, but has some significant areas to improve with the shooting and even more importantly for me with just kind of overall consistent competitiveness. So I think he was the perfect fit for them. And I give a lot of credit to Elton Brand and the 76ers ownership for getting that deal done and bringing in Doc to be their head coach.
Yeah, I think as much as anything in Philadelphia, you need a coach with some gravitas. Like, you need someone that can stand in that locker room and instantly command the respect of Embiid and Simmons. That effectively takes a lot of the high-profile assistant coaches off the table for that particular job. So Doc checks that box. I mean, I think Philadelphia, though, is these next few years are really important for, you know, the legacy of Doc Rivers. It's been 12 years since he won that championship in Boston. And since then, you know, there's been two undeniably disappointing playoff exits with the Clippers. There was the blown 3-1 lead against Houston back in, 2015. There was this year. And you can certainly argue that circumstances going into the bubble were extremely challenging for the Clippers. But when you fail at the level that, you know, kind of Doc failed at, being up 3-1, a lot of it's on you. So, you know, if you're Doc Rivers, these are a very important next few years because, you know, there's a whole generation, Ryan, that don't remember the championship in Boston, that, you know Doc Rivers as the Clippers coach and what he accomplished or didn't accomplish there. I mean, I don't know about you, but I look at this as being incredibly important for Doc Rivers to continue to have the reputation of being a high-level coach.
Yeah, I think it is important, Chris, but you know, going back to his time with the Clippers, especially what happened with the flameout in the Orlando bubble, as you mentioned, blowing a 3-1 lead in the Western Conference semifinals, you know, I will say this, like, is it Doc Rivers' fault that Marcus Morris chose to show up late to the bubble in Orlando? Is it his fault that Lou Williams decided to leave the bubble for a funeral and then stopped at a strip club to get wings? You know, is it his fault that Montrezl Harrell was out of the bubble for almost a month or more and wasn't as effective when he came back? So that's why it's difficult for me. I understand the business. It's an unfair business. One of the shocking things, Chris, that I had to double and triple check to make sure it was true is that of the top five seeds in the Western Conference, which clearly is the better, more talented and deeper conference top to bottom in the NBA, of the top five seeds, three of them have had head coaching changes this offseason. The LA Clippers, the Oklahoma City Thunder, and the Houston Rockets, Chris, all are looking for new head coaches. So that's why it's so hard to coach in the NBA. So I bring that up because, yeah, you're right. You know, Doc, it certainly was not his best coaching performance this year. I think he would admit to that. But, you know, there were a lot of mitigating circumstances with the LA Clippers, you know, and what they did or didn't do in the bubble. And I think with Philadelphia, he has the perfect opportunity with a talented team. The roster is a little bit flawed, in my opinion. It's too front court heavy. They need more shooting. They need to figure out, you know, why are we paying Al Horford $28 million a year to back up Joel Embiid? That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. So they need some depth. They need some roster balance. They need more shooting. But I think most importantly, they have a guy who's a leader who will be firm and try to get Embiid in shape, help Simmons with his shooting, increase his competitiveness. And then I think if they're able to do that and make a few minor roster tweaks, Chris, they can be back in contention to win the Eastern Conference Championship relatively quickly.
Yeah, I mean, look, they've got two top, whatever you want to say, 10, 15, 20, however you place the Embiid-Simmons combination. The question is going to be, how do they get better? I mean, to your point, it's a flawed roster. It doesn't have a lot of perimeter shooting. Now, maybe Doc Rivers comes in and harnesses something, you know, in Tobias Harris that improves him from this past season. Tobias obviously had a career year under Doc Rivers with the Clippers, so that's certainly a plus. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know how you, there's only so much you can do coaching wise to resolve a lack of shooting and to resolve some of the imperfections that they have on that roster. I mean, if you're Elton Brand and Elton Brand's come out and said, like, I'm in charge now, whatever the situation was before the dynamic, I'm not entirely sure, but he's like, I'm in charge now. How do you improve that team? I mean, is it just as simple as you've got to hit on these first and second round picks that you have, or do you see a pathway to kind of balancing out that roster, like you said?
Yeah, I don't think it'll be with late first round picks and certainly not second round picks in the short term as far as moving the needle. I think the deal that was, you know, speculated, has been speculated with Horford plus, and I don't know what the plus is going to Sacramento for Buddy Hield. Something like that would make a lot of sense. Now, if I'm the Sacramento Kings front office, Chris, I need a lot more, obviously, than just Al Horford at 34 for Buddy Hield, who's 27, even if Buddy is disgruntled in Sacramento. But I would be making those kind of calls and looking at those kind of deals if I'm Elton Brand. Say, okay, you know, is Al Horford plus a guy they don't want to trade, but to get something, you have to give something. Is Al Horford plus Matthias Thybul for Buddy Hield something you would consider, you know, Sacramento? So deals along those lines, Chris, where you're not touching your two best players in Embiid and Simmons. You mentioned Tobias Harris. Teams, I think, are a little bit skittish about that contract at $35 million a year on a five-year deal, you know, as far as taking that money on. But I also want to see if Tobias Harris can play better under Doc Rivers, because he played some of the best basketball of his career under Doc in L.A., and theoretically, conceptually, Harris gives Embiid and Simmons what they need. It's another shooter, another floor spacer. So I would start with Horford. I don't know if there's any market for Horford. He has 2 years guaranteed at a high level and then a partial guarantee in year three. Chris, that's a tough nut to swallow for a lot of teams financially, especially with the pandemic and the salary cap and luxury tax, at best staying flat artificially or more likely going down if left to their own devices. So, but I would start there from Elton Brand. It's a tough task, but you may have to load it up with picks or young players and try to do something to balance out your roster a little bit, get more shooting, get more talent in the backcourt, and give your two best players, Embiid and Simmons, the chance to be effective, and give Doc Rivers a chance to use a team that isn't so front court heavy and has a better balanced roster than you had this past season.
Yeah, the plus part of Horford plus is what's problematic for the Sixers, because I think there'd be a lot of interest in Matisse Thybul. I don't know if you're Philadelphia, if you want to get rid of him. I mean, you need cheap talent in Philly. Like, you've got to have guys that are under manageable contracts, and Thybul's, you know, under a rookie deal and will be for the next few seasons. I think he's going to be a very good player. You know, he's already a good defensive player, and I think you can unlock some different things in his offensive game. That's gonna be challenging to find pieces, whether it's via trade or free agency, to make that team significantly more balanced. I mean, they were balanced a year ago when they had J.J. Redick and Jimmy Butler. And I don't know about you, man, but like, you look at decisions over the last 20 years, like the Jimmy Butler decision, and really that decision in general to not bring back that team that was a Kawhi Leonard shot away from potentially making the conference finals. That decision could be one of the more haunting for a front office in recent memory. Butler's well on his way to being a huge asset for the Heat, you know, not just this season, but in the years to come. And the Sixers, you know, basically got little to nothing for him. I mean, Josh Richardson's a nice player, but, you know, they gave up a cornerstone guy for basically nothing. That's the kind of decision, Ryan, that you know, gets entire front offices fired, frankly, for losing out on a guy like that.
Yeah, it can. I mean, you mentioned they were right there a year ago with Toronto, and you would think after what Toronto went on to do when they got past the 76ers in the second round, you know, flipping the script on Milwaukee when they were down 2-0, coming back to win four games in a row and blitz through the Eastern Conference Finals, and then in particular beating Golden State in the finals. I know Golden State had the injuries to KD and Clay, but it was still a loaded Warriors team who was in their fifth finals in a row and gunning for their fourth championship. So you would think if you're Philadelphia, the more likely approach would be, hey, we're very close. We're not that far away. Let's keep this group together, try to improve the team around the margins. Maybe we can't pay, say, Jimmy Butler and J.J. Redick, but, you know, if we're going to let J.J. go, let's pay Jimmy and not get, you know, carried away with Al Horford, who – and that was the head-scratching one for me, Chris, because you watch the Boston Celtics very closely. You know that team as well as anybody. At this point in Al Horford's career, with how he's aging, and especially with the way the league is going, with pace and space in the shooting, Al Horford, to me, is a center and exclusively a center. So to pay a guy $25 to $30 million on a four-year deal who is essentially on your team a backup center because you have one of the best bigs in the league in Joel Embiid, I just didn't understand it at the time. I really don't understand it now. And that's why I think Philly would have a hard time moving on from Horford's contract. I don't think anything team in the league would take him just straight up, even into cap space. So it's what are the Philadelphia 76ers willing to attach to Horford and what can they get back in return? But to your point, Chris, you know, it's trying to stop the bleeding from decisions made last summer that put the franchise in a relatively difficult spot, especially when we're talking about championship contending over the next couple of years.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't think teams are just absorbing that Horford contract, especially with several of them trying to create cap space for the summer of 2021. It just seems like a little far-fetched to me. Real quick on one other thing. I didn't put this on the rundown, but I want to throw it at you. The Kyrie comments in the Kevin Durant podcast. Like, if you're Sean Marks, like, what are you thinking today after, you know, forget the stuff about Kyrie and LeBron and Kevin Durant, and I'm looking down, I'm seeing a guy that could make a shot for the first time. Like, whatever. Like, that's just Kyrie, you know, being Kyrie. But the idea of, like, a revolving door of coaching where Steve Nash isn't really the coach. One day it could be Jacques Vaughn. One day it could be me. One day it could be Kevin Durant. I mean, Kyrie likes to blame the media for this stuff, but he's on a podcast with one of his closest friends, his new teammate, and he's just saying this stuff. So, like, if you're Sean Marks and you just bring in Steve Nash and you hear what Kyrie said, what are you thinking right now?
Well, Chris, maybe one day it could be me and you. I mean, we should apply. You know how, like, a couple years ago the Sacramento Kings did that thing with crowdsourcing for the NBA draft? Like, they asked the fans who to draft, and they came up with Nick Stauskas. Maybe the Brooklyn Nets will do that. I obviously, you know, say that in jest. But
yeah.
What I would do if I'm Sean Marks, Chris, is say Kyrie, said, look, and this is where, because it is Kyrie who said it, Chris, it gets magnified and amplified because of his history. If you listen to the whole interview and read the full quote, it was more along the lines of, hey, look, we have a lot of high-level basketball minds. We'll do it collaboratively. However, because it is Kyrie and because of specifically what he said, it was not interpreted that way. So if I'm Sean Marks, and this is the perfect opportunity, in some ways, actually, I may be glad he did it now, because by whenever next season starts, it'll have died down. You know, I call him or sit down with him in person if I can and say, look, Kyrie, I know what you were trying to say is that we have a talented group of players who are high-level thinkers. We have a talented staff led by Steve Nash and Jacques Vaughn and others. However, the way this was interpreted is nobody's really in charge. And with Steve Nash, who's a brilliant player, he's one of the greatest basketball players and basketball minds in the history of the NBA, but he is very very new to coaching at any level. Chris, as you know, he was a consultant for the Warriors. He lived in LA and traveled to the Bay Area occasionally. He was only around the team maybe a couple times a month. So he hasn't been, never mind being a head coach, he hasn't been a bench assistant and gone through the 82-game grind on the coaching side of it. So Kyrie, why it's, you know, I understand what you're trying to say, but would be really important and impactful, not only for me and for Steve, but for the entire franchise, is next time you get an opportunity, say, look, Steve Nash is going to be a great coach. He is our guy. I stand behind him 100%. We see the game the same way. I feel it. Kevin Durant feels it. DeAndre Jordan, whoever you want to name on the roster, we're totally in line with him. He's off to a great start. I love everything he's doing, and I support whatever he's doing 100%. I think you use the next opportunity to do that if you're Kyrie Irving, Chris, and then a lot of the nonsense over the past couple weeks quiets down and to some extent goes away.
And just, I mean, take some ownership of it too. Like, don't blame the media for, you know, interpreting something. You said it. You said all the things. Like, and people in the media are just, you know, printing it, you know, your quote word for word. It's just, it's a little wild when it comes to Kyrie. But I you can give him the benefit of the doubt there. To your point, it was kind of a parsed statement that made the rounds in the media. But, you know, you've got to, if you're Kyrie and Kevin Durant from day one, you've got to throw your full throat support behind Steve Nash. There can't be any doubts that you believe in his coaching acumen, or else things could get off the rails pretty quickly in Brooklyn. All right, a couple things I want to finish with. You know, the Warriors kind of lurking out there. They were part of the, you know, group of eight that had, you know, whatever practices they had in the last couple of weeks. You know, Klay Thompson back at practice, by all accounts, looks fine out there. So the Warriors going to run back Steph, Klay, and Draymond, the core players on a team that, you know, just a few years ago did win 72 games. They're also going to have the number two pick in the draft. Now, you've kind of looked at this draft a little bit. You know the value of these high draft picks. I mean, how valuable is that number two pick to the Warriors, either in terms of them using it and drafting somebody or potentially flipping it?
Chris, I've said all along since the Warriors started struggling way back now a year ago in 2019, and then especially early in 2020 when Klay, it was clear that he wasn't going to play this year, and then Steph, you know, injured his hand and he was out for the year, and they were one of the worst teams in the league. In fact, they had the worst record in the league before the pandemic shut the league down in March. I said the great part about this for the Warriors is they're as well positioned as any team who's ever been in this position, at least in recent history, in the last 20 or so years since I've been involved with the NBA, to trade that pick or to explore trade scenarios to bring in another veteran impact player and get their team back to a championship level immediately, as soon as next season, Chris. And I feel that is the case. The best fake trade I've come up with that I think makes a lot of sense for both sides, and I've been on record for probably, 6 to 9 months now, saying I think both teams would have to think long and hard about this one, Chris. Let me ask you a question. Who says no if Bob Myers, the GM of the Golden State Warriors, calls Tommy Shepard, the GM of the Washington Wizards, and Myers says to Shepard, said, Tommy, I will give you Andrew Wiggins, the number two pick in this year's draft, and Minnesota's first round pick in next year's draft in 2021, Chris, that is only protected to three for Bradley Beal. Chris, who says yes, who says no? Because I think that deal makes a ton of sense for both sides. For the Warriors, they bring in Beal alongside the Splash Brothers and Draymond. And then if you're Washington, you want to retain Bradley Beal. But my guess is you'll never get a better offer than that because it is the number two pick in the 2019 draft, excuse me, in the 2020 draft, and it could be another top five pick a year from now.
Yeah, I think, look, the Warriors do it all day long, even though the price is pretty steep with those couple of draft picks. Washington, and this is just my opinion, Washington would think long and hard about it because they've, you know, going back to the trade deadline this past year, they've charted a course that puts them with Beal, Wall, and Davis Bertans next year. Now, I don't know what that wins. It probably gets you in the playoffs in the Eastern Conference, but next year with Wall coming off such a major injury, I don't know how far you get, but they've seemed pretty committed to, you know, that group of players getting some run together. But that's a really appetizing offer to have the potential to draft, you know, whether it's James Wiseman or whomever, Anthony Edwards, if he's on the table at that point, and to have a pick from Minnesota next year. And look, I like the Timberwolves as a team, but in the Western Conference, they could be 15th next year or 14th next year. And that's going to be, that's going to put them in a tough spot. I mean, I think that would just, that would probably, you know, make the Wizards regret turning down the offers they did for Bertans at the deadline. But that may be the only pill to swallow. Cause then you'd kind of like, correct me if you think I'm wrong, but if you make that deal, if you're the Wizards, you then kind of transition to a team that may be building around John Wall, but now you're kind of like trying to rehabilitate him to the point where you trade him too. You know, you get him healthier. So you'd have to make kind of a fundamental shift in the kind of team you're hoping to be, but I'm with you. That's a huge offer. You are, you know, look, there'll be teams looking to, you know, get Bradley Beal, no question about it, but I'm not sure there'd be an offer on the table as big as the one you're talking about.
Yeah, because the number two pick is guaranteed. The draft's a month or so away at this point. You know where it's going to be. You know who the players are. And then next year, as you mentioned, I think Minnesota's going to be improved with, you know, Karl Anthony Towns coming back healthy, with D'Angelo Russell having, you know, preseason training camp and all that. But Chris, to your point, what does that mean in the Western Conference? I mean, look at the other 14 teams in the conference. And you know, one of the easiest thing in the world to do is, you know, a lot of fans and even some media members do this, Chris, say, oh, this team's a playoff team in the West next year. That team's a playoff playoff team. And I said, guys, if one goes in, one goes out. And if Golden State is one of those teams who's in next year and you think somebody else, whether it's New Orleans, Memphis, Phoenix, Minnesota, whoever you think it is a playoff team next year, then that means two go out. And which of those two, as you look up and down the Western Conference, Chris, in the top eight in particular in this year's playoffs, which of those two were to go out? So it's very difficult. And I bring that up because I'm not trying to pile on the Minnesota Timberwolves, but it's all but assured to be a lottery pick, potentially a high lottery pick, because I think if you were betting next year, you'd say the Timberwolves are likely to be closer to 15th than they are to even 8th in playoff contention next year in the West. So that's why if you're Washington and that offer is on the table and you turn it down, boy, you better be right. You better be right that it works with Wall and Beal and Bertans, keeping in mind that Wall is you know, a mess physically with his injuries. And then Bertans, you know, has had two torn ACLs in the past as well, Chris. So it's a gamble for both sides. And that's why, you know, when I started thinking of this deal at the beginning of 2020, I said, holy cow, it's risky for both teams, but it also makes a ton of sense for both teams if they can pull it off.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. The more I think about it, the more I'm convinced it is a pretty good deal for both sides. For the Warriors, despite what you're giving up, it puts you – if it's all your guys in the same kind of generation, so to speak, like you're maintaining your path to a championship. And I think Curry, Beal, and Klay Thompson could all play together in today's NBA. I don't think you need to have a traditional small forward. And man, we thought their death lineup was tough, you know, before. I mean, that's a tough death lineup they'd play with now. Last thing, as we go into the offseason, you know, as you look at all the teams across the NBA, excluding maybe the ones that we talked about, what's the most interesting team? What team has the most interesting offseason ahead for them, I guess? I'm looking, Ryan, at the Toronto Raptors, because I think they not only have to make decisions for themselves, but I think they can also reshape the championship race with some of the decisions they could make, whether it's trading a Kyle Lowry to a contender that may absorb him and have a big piece to a championship puzzle, or allowing a Serge Ibaka to go. It seems like Marc Gasol, based on some of the reports, is already gone, you know, signing over in Spain. That's been widely reported in the local press out there. But they, to me, are the most interesting team. Like, Masai Ujiri clearly has a plan for 2021 free agency. He's got some very good players there, young players there. Van Vliet, I think, will be back on some kind of deal. Pascal Siakam is still a stud, despite his struggles in this postseason. Toronto, to me, is the most interesting. Which is the most interesting team to you?
The LA Clippers. I think they're under the most immediate pressure in just about every way possible, Chris, starting with their head coaching search. My guess is that lands with Tyronn Lue being named the head coach of the LA Clippers. He's been there. And I bring it up, Chris, because I don't think you can go with an assistant who's never been a head coach or, you know, anybody other than a veteran proven coach who knows the team, knows the players, and has proven that he can win at a high level. Tyronn Lue has obviously done that. That's why I think he'll end up as the head coach of the LA Clippers. But look at the downside, Chris. They traded away picks or pick swaps, I believe, through 2027. This year in free agency, they have some difficult decisions. Now, keep in mind, they also have a huge advantage because they have not only the wealthiest owner in the NBA and Steve Ballmer, but Steve Ballmer is one of the wealthiest men in the country, in the entire world. So they have some significant financial advantages, but they do have some tough decisions to make. Unrestricted free agents for the Clippers include Marcus Morris, who they gave up a first-round pick to get at the trade deadline from the New York Knicks. Also Montrezl Harrell, who had a terrific regular season. He was sixth man of the year, Chris, but I thought was somewhat exposed in the playoffs against Nikola Jokic in particular. If you're going to want, you know, eight-figure contracts, Chris, getting 10, you know, 15 million, whatever you want as Montrezl Harrell, you got to prove that at least you cannot get destroyed in a playoff series against Nikola Jokic, which is what I thought happened when the Clippers played the Denver Nuggets. So you have a tough decision there. And then also Jamichael Green, I thought played a very nice role. His shooting and floor spacing was important. You know, he has a player option, so you have at least two in Morris and Harrell, and maybe three with Jamichael Green, key free agents this year. But more importantly, Chris, if things don't go well next season, well, then you have Kawhi Leonard and Paul George approaching free agency. They have the ability to opt out of their contracts. You know, I'm obviously, as anybody would be, a lot more concerned about Leonard than George in that scenario, but you have to get it right. They've, you know, we want to talk about risk tolerance and gambles. LA Clippers gambled as much as any team in recent NBA history by pushing all their chips in to get Paul George, which in turn led to Kawhi Leonard. But it's a very short window, Chris. They blew it in year one. Can they resurrect it in year two? Who's their head coach going to be? And can they do enough to keep Kawhi with the Clippers long term? That's why I'm really fascinated with this team and what they do in the offseason.
You know, it's interesting to tie the two teams we're talking about together. You know, I'm not sure how the Clippers would do it, but I mean, if I'm LA, I'd go after Kyle Lowry. I'd probably try to acquire him in a deal. That's just the kind of guy that you'd want to get your hands on. Now, I have, and you know the dynamics of front offices, I'm not so sure that Masai Ujiri is looking to do a deal with Lawrence Frank at this point, given everything that went down with Kawhi last year. I mean, it's being honest, that's kind of the way it is. But if you're the Clippers to take on Kyle and bring him in, obviously he works with Kawhi. He's kind of the right fit for that group. But it's interesting. Like, I mean, it's pretty clear to me, Ryan, that, you know, Doc Rivers had some strong conversations with Steve Ballmer. There clearly was a difference of opinion on that team and how to coach them and basically whether they were, you know, good enough to win on their own. I mean, do you look at that team? Like, we talked about kind of the Sixers being imbalanced. Do you look at the Clippers as being, you know, with that current roster, let's assume they run, you know, 90, 95% of it back. Are they, I mean, having seen what they've become, are they a championship level team?
Well, I really like your Kyle Lowry trade idea. I think mechanically with the contracts, it'd be tough to pull it off. And you mentioned the tension and friction between the two teams, given that Kawhi won a championship in Toronto in 2019 and then left shortly thereafter for LA as a free agent. We all know some of the gray area the Clippers seem to play in his not only scouting, but free agent recruitment and all that. So there are some hard feelings there. But I love your thought, Chris. And I'm thinking along the same lines that the LA Clippers need another playmaker. They need a passer. One guy I think is probably more attainable or maybe more attainable, Chris, that I would take a serious look at if I'm in the front office for the LA Clippers, that is Spencer Dinwiddie with the Brooklyn Nets. He's proven that he can play at a high level and score at a high level. He was fantastic this year. But now next year, you have Kyrie Irving coming in. You have Kevin Durant coming in. Caris LeVert was one of the breakout performers in the bubble. He's got a little more size. He's a wing, but he handles the ball a lot too. So there can be too much of a good thing. Chris, we experienced that when I was GM of the Phoenix Suns and we had Goran Dragic, Eric Bledsoe, and Isaiah Thomas. It looked great on paper, but those guys weren't necessarily happy with their roles and the thing kind of blew up on us. So I bring that up because if I'm Lawrence Frank or in the front office for the Clippers, I want more passing. I want more facilitation. I have enough wing talent and depth. I have enough defensive potential. I have all that stuff, but I need a playmaker to get the ball to Paul George and Kawhi Leonard in spots to make sure we're not so isolation heavy. And I'm really calling the Brooklyn Nets to figure out what do they want for Spencer Dinwiddie. He's proven that he's a good player at this point. He's on a reasonable contract, and I think he'd really help the best players in LA, led by Kawhi and PG, look a lot better and help our team move the ball more. So keep an eye on that one. That's what I'd be thinking if I were, again, Lawrence Frank or working for him in the Clippers front office.
Yeah, it'd be a real interesting offseason to LA. The pressure wasn't on last season. If it wasn't championship or bust last season, as Paul George said, it's at least finals or bust for this team this year. That's undeniable. Ryan, always appreciate your time, man. Always learn something. Thanks for taking some time to join me. You can catch Ryan Scal and Pals Monday through Friday, noon Eastern, over at radio.com. Thanks for joining me, man.
Hey, Chris, always great to be on with you. And as recently as we've done this, I'm going to assume it's a recurring segment going forward. So call me in a couple more weeks, and I'll come back on with you. We'll do the offseason breakdown.
Looking forward to it.